Okay, so our speaker is Mike G. Welcome, Mike, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Louisa. I love the brevity of all of the pre-meeting particulars for Tasnua and a lot of other secular meetings. Well, my name is Mike, and I am whatever you think I am. I am in recovery, and that is primarily from the human condition because I didn't sign up for it. And but here we are. And I'll start with a bit of the background. I was born in Los Angeles in 1962. That makes me 61, two. Yeah, 61. I'll be 62 in November. And my childhood was, I guess from the looks of it, not, unusual or, it seemed pretty, middle class. And I, my folks were from Buffalo in southern Ontario, Canada. And so after I was probably about five, we moved over there and we were by family. Their parents and siblings were all living there. So I was able to hang out with my cousins and aunts and uncles, most of whom we ended up being just, a few streets away from each other, in the suburbs of Buffalo. And it really was quite a nice setup, couple things is that for one, I was a sensitive child, I think. I'm not sure more sensitive than others, but I feel that that is the right thing to, to label myself there. I also wanted to do the right thing. So I strived to be a good boy. And I have a sister named Jody. She is a year and a half younger than me. She also is dead. She died a couple years ago of ovarian cancer. And we were pretty close growing up, not as much later on, mainly because well, it's kind of the way I am, but you'll find out a little bit more about how I'm wired in a few minutes, I suppose, if you don't already know. But I was adopted and she was adopted, and a lot of folks, and I've read about it and I've heard people talk about it. Being adopted is an interesting thing. For me, it's a blessing. And the reason why I say that is because it means that I'm not related to anybody in my family of origin, because they're all extremely dull and uninteresting to me. Now, I do love them because of the proximity and they tried hard. I can give them that. My mom passed away in January, and my dad passed away or didn't pass away, not yet. That's so funny. That was just coming rolled out. But he's pretty fucking old, and he didn't know what to do. And I was talking with him almost every day, which is very unusual. But he has this penchant for toxicity, and so. I haven't spoken to him in a while. And that is good for me. Not sure how it is for him. Don't care. So, moved to Buffalo, grew up high school. I was shy. I felt like everybody had some knowledge about how to, be that I didn't get. And and looking at the cool kids in the cafeteria, I would it's it felt like I had a it felt like I had like a ticket, but I didn't know how to be. I was very self-conscious. So could I sit at the cool kids table? Would they laugh at me? Am I cool enough to roll up the sleeves of my shirt like all the guys do? Back in the 70s, there was a period of time where we were wearing silk shirts with all these kind of cool designs. And but the other thing about being adopted too is that I never really had a need to find my family of origin. So I know because I hear people talk about it, how important it is for lineage and that background. And, I come from a long line of whatevers. And I'm not sure if it's because of the circumstances or because of my sort of outlook on life, that we're all naked, cold, and nobody has to be here. And so this thing about family and all this is it's all evolutionary, and we're all alone, and we think we know each other, and we get to know each other in a certain way, but we don't even know our own selves, in some ways as well. So, and I wake up every morning and I'm like, oh fuck, okay, I'll do this, and I could, it's another day. I didn't, I'm glad for it. I like being alive. And but the interesting thing about it is that I guess, for me, well, I searched for a meaning for a long time because people said that there was one, or at least it was implied. And there's all these religions and stuff like that. And I was searching for all these things. And I got to a point eventually, and I may ramble into some of this as well, but where at the end of the day, that there is no meaning inherent in anything that goes on. I know this is exciting, but as a human, it appears as though I need meaning in order to be happy. So I figured, well, how the fuck does that work then? If there's nothing that has the meaning, or I search for it and I can't find it, but do I find it and then I lose it? Is it possible, or can I lock it up? I mean, I have no idea, right? So it just kind of occurred to me that, like, yeah, there is no meaning, but that's not a sad thing. Once I realize that, I'm fucking free. That means I don't have to search anymore for what it is out there, All I need to do is be, and and not be a dick. So the meaning is what I put into it for myself. And I also figured out too that I'm thinking humans, but I know I need to be around other people. We're social beings, and so as much as I say, and I think I don't like that, I really kind of do, but I but in in spurts. So I love being around people and interacting with people, sharing experience, strength, and hope, the human condition, and how I'm getting through it and hearing how others are getting through it. And all that kind of stuff. I've had some things, happen to me, like losing a child. Our daughter Rachel, at the age of 15, suicide. I was 20 years sober, didn't drink, and I knew that would make it worse, and I needed to be there for Julie and for Zach. and got divorced 10 years later, 30 years sober. Didn't drink, and that ended up being a very good thing, actually, because I was able to self-actualize unimpeded by the trappings of all the things attached to a marriage in the mind and all that. And some grief with that, grief with the loss of Rachel. And the thing that I find has ha I found has happened for me is that I go through life for a period of time, being pretty fat, dumb, and happy, and being a pasty white dude in a pasty white dude's world, it seems. A lot of things that I'm not necessarily aware of in terms of trials and tribulations of others and stuff like that. I can't complain. I really can't. I have a job I like, and I've been doing it for, over 20 years, and I, they like me and they pay me, and it's all good. But when you go through these things, it's obviously these things happen. It's a human thing. And so you make it through in whatever way you can. And you also need, and when I say you, I mean me really, the help of others to get through it. So there's something that Bill W. talked about called, he referred to it as like a kinship of our common suffering. We're a lot like survivors of a shipwreck and stuff like that. And I like those kinds of analogies. I like most analogies, actually. And because the experience that we've gone through, we can share with others and be helpful. And when we're in that place, when I was in that place, I found that other people sharing their experience with me was very helpful. So I think that's part of how humans get through it. Like with death, in the old days before we third partied it out, we used to get together and make meals and build a coffin. Or, and the community would be together. And a lot of that is missing these days, So I found that for me, it's important for me to find a few close friends, companions in this walk, a tribe, a larger tribe, and a tribe within a tribe, and that type of thing. It's helped. It helps me get through, whatever it is that this thing is, and I like the connection. I've been sober since, I came into AA for the first time after losing a job, and I think it was September, October of 83. So it was a while back, and from that time to when I got sober, which was like 4.5 years later, I joined the Navy, got kicked out of the Navy, got shot. Yeah, I forgot to mention that one too. That was a pretty bizarre ordeal. And recently too, like last week, I was supposed to speak here July 4th, and I spaced it or slept through it. And then like, fuck, that almost never happens. I can't remember when it has, but I feel as though it may have happened before. But so we reschedule. But in the meantime, last Saturday, not the one that just prior to 2 Saturdays ago, I thought long and hard about it, and then I decided, I think I'll have a heart attack. Yeah, no, that's not how it happened, but that is what happened. And I had 100% blockage in my right coronary artery. And, I was eating pretty good because the love of my life makes my meals for me because she wants me to be healthy. And that's pretty good. But then I supplement like late night snacks with a fucking block of cheese and crackers and, generally good snacks, but not really portion control. And, but yet over the years, when I was doing keto, lot of fats and, which, I'm given to understand it works when you just stick with that. But when you supplement it, with a little bit of carbs or more carbs, it's not so good. I don't know. I'm still figuring this stuff out, but I do know this is that I'm on a Mediterranean diet now and I'll be doing cardio rehab. It was successful and all that kind of stuff. And it's the kind of thing that, I mean, it humbles you for sure. And it's another one of those fat, dumb, and happy and whoops kind of things. And it's weird for me because I'm almost, it's going to sound fucking weird, but I'm almost grateful for things like that, because it does reset me. And I know that's a strange thing to say, especially because loved ones, I mean, like I put them through shit. I put them through some stuff and, it wasn't on purpose, So, but I'm cognizant of that, And I was, in the ambulance there, and I was sort of like, yeah, you're having a heart attack is what the guy said to me. And I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And I thought, well, then, if I don't make it to the hospital, because they had to divert me, take me to another one. I was like, well, I could die. Am I okay with that? I was like, I am. And the reason is because, what I don't even, this thing of identity and this thing of self and this thing of free will and all this kind of stuff. I think it's all illusion, but it's pervasive illusion. It's something that we all see and hear and think in every day, at least I do anyway. So I'm like, well, I'll go with it. So it is how I need it in order to keep this thing going. I can't like ignore it. But I put it in the back of my mind. And it protects me from a lot of things, actually. It protects me from a lot of pain and woe. Because if shit don't matter, then it's like, oh, what the fuck, So was I okay with that? And I'm like, yeah, because I really don't also have a choice. I mean, my life is in other people's hands here. So, and will I know it? I probably won't even know it, I felt sad for other people because I know what it's like to have someone you love die. But beyond that, it is what it is, and the wheel spins around. So that's where I was. But they did what they did, and I'm glad. And I'm glad that Julie was there and knew what to do. And she was calm as shit. I'm impressed. Before when we were living separately, she's been back here for a year. I could have been alone, so I feel very lucky, and I have felt lucky, after getting shot and and this is yeah, and I don't think to myself, why me when all these other people are like, nope, it is what it is. I have no idea. When I used to believe that, there was a, some sort of anthropomorphic kind of deity, intervening type of deal that that had some sort of, logic. I'm using that term very fucking loosely about, who lives, who dies, or whatever. And then the whole thing too about it's like, well, God is either good or omniscient or omnipotent or maybe any two of those, but he can't be all three. Maybe he can be one or two, but not all three, because it would be contradictory. And then I'd be like, well, that's just us puny humans trying to figure all this out. Who the fuck are we trying to do all that? And especially because I was a born again Christian for 15 years during my sobriety, and there was some benefits to it, but mostly for me it was shitty. I had I had to adopt a view of life, because that's what you do, that my interpretation of it, based on other people's interpretations of it, I think were restrictive, and I think may have harmed those in my family and around me. And when I look at like the real me, whatever, or the pattern of the me's that I've seen and known over the years, that is not who I am, you know? But, you know, that was a thing. So I used to try to figure that stuff out, you know? And when you come into this program and they talk about, you know, aligning your will with God's will, you know, I was trying to think about what the fuck that was. And oftentimes it would be, I would kind of think like, you know, if a bunch of obstacles are coming up, then maybe it's not his will. Or if shit's running like very smoothly, then maybe it is, right? But you would never know. And, you know, the fucker ghosted me, you know, is what happened. I never heard back, never heard back. So, but actually, no, I started out as a skeptic. I mean, that's my training in college and stuff like that. And the people who taught me actually were the ones in Amherst, New York, at University of Buffalo, that, you know, run, you know, the Skeptical Inquirer, and that organization that puts that magazine out. And some of them were my teachers, you know. So I learned how to be a critical thinker early on. And so like, well, so how did I go for something like that, right? And it's because of a misapplication of logic, because I thought to myself, and there's a bunch of them, like, well, it's been here for a long time, you know, appeal to authority. Or what I really did was I suspended my disbelief, and basically I said, if either like a third of the planet, or however much, 2/3, is batshit crazy, or maybe they got something, and I just don't know. Maybe it's that thing that, you know, the more you think about it, the more you know, and all that kind of stuff, you know, and all these kinds of statements like lean not on your own understanding, and all that kind of stuff. So I thought to myself, well, I'll participate in this until it runs its course or whatever, you know. And it did run its course. My disbelief slowly flittered back to the ground. So the thing that, you know, when you come into sobriety, and initially I was just a sort of a kind of looked like a hippie, in the sense of my thoughts and values, I suppose. But more like Frank Zappa, you know, kind of anti-hippie, I suppose. And, you know, but unlike Zappa, I did do a shit ton of drugs and hallucinogens, which I think may have affected me, in some negative ways. But I know that the hallucinogens, also, are responsible for a certain perspective that I have, which I am grateful for, which is that things are not necessarily what they seem and what I think they are. And we all have different perspectives. I did hallucinogens because I thought I could find the unencumbered truth with a capital T. And you know that our five senses are like pinholes in a shoebox top, looking out at everything, and that's what prevents us from experiencing the universe unimpeded. And well, what I did find was that because of the senses and because I'm human, it's not going to happen. It's impossible for me to observe and experience the universe unimpeded, at least in that kind of way. But at least I knew that, oh, there's different ways of looking at it, that's for sure. And that's really all that I need to know about that, that there's different ways of looking at it. And I've learned from people that there's different perspectives and all that. And it took me a long fucking time, but I've only just in the last several years learned that they're all valid. They're all valid. If someone is experiencing something, it is what they're experiencing. It's valid. And who the fuck am I to undermine that, to deny that, to minimize it, to gaslight it, or any of that kind of thing? And that's a fucking hard lesson to learn. Even when, I thought I knew that, I'm still learning that kind of thing, because what I stopped doing was, like I said, I'm not looking for the capital T, truth. I thought being right was a worthy goal to reach in any situation. I realize now it's actually an obstacle. The need to be right is an obstacle for me. What I need to be is, like Ted Lasso said, curious, not judgmental. And that is some powerful stuff for me. And if I can keep that in mind, I'll keep beginner's mind and keep learning. So going through just a bit of, I guess, the trending of the alcoholism, I started later than everybody else I know partying because I wanted to be a good boy. And I think it might have been that my dad pissed me off once or something like that. But what happened was I was trying to be good, and I wasn't rewarded for being good. The feeling that I got from my parents was, and particularly my dad, was that, and it may or may not have been what was coming from them, but it is what I experienced, which is that it's not, it's not okay to be you, as you are. You need to be this. You need to be going here. You need to be doing this. And and there wasn't a lot of we weren't folks that did this, emotional getting together and saying you're sorry and all that kind of stuff. It was dysfunctional and in a lot of ways. But I mean, there was no alcohol involved in or anything like that. Just sort of, I guess untreated mental illness. But my dad was a rageaholic, is the way I used to think of it. Who knows what I'm not going to diagnose, but there's something. But so being good didn't reward me. So and if you know the child order model, the hero, the scapegoat, the lost child, and the mascot, when I first got sober, all that stuff was kind of coming around, and the codependency stuff was coming around back in January 18th of 88. There I go back to the explain. That was when I got sober. That was a big thing, and inner child work and stuff like that. And so I started out as the hero child, and I think I played the scapegoat a lot of times. The way I look at these models, well, a lot of models anyway, is sort of like they're a pretty good loose explanation of how things can be, and they're based on observations and stuff like that. But it's not like they're fucking real, so I was just sort of each of those four items, and there's probably models with five, and maybe they've discovered a sixth one in a cave in New Mexico, I don't know. But they're like roles, that I played. It's like you try this one, oh, it doesn't work. You try this one, doesn't work. You try this one, and without even full realizing it, I think that was kind of where I was going, and just trying to make it, you know, trying to be something that where people weren't, you know, telling me that it wasn't good or that they weren't mad at me. I mean, that's pretty much what my childhood and most of my adulthood has been, is trying to do that. Another thing is that I was outer oriented in the sense that, you know, coming in and hearing the regular stuff and regular meetings and, you know, higher power and, you know, so I had a kind of a, you know, sort of a hippy dippy higher power type of thing. Nothing concrete, you know. You know, and that worked. And like I said, then probably about 5 years in, I think, is when I took up the sword and the cross. And I think that lasted about 15 years. And so the different perspectives that I had. I heard things like, you know, there's a lot of doctrine, and there's a lot of dogma. And Bill W. talked about dogma. He talked about good dogma and bad dogma. And you know, it's a shame that you know, one of my favorite things is looking at, I think it was on AA Agnostica, bunch of quotes about, you know, being a free thinker, agnostic, atheist in AA, and how Bill, in one letter to a colleague, was saying, you know, they would excommunicate me if I every time I, you know, if I tried to change a word of the book or you know, the steps or whatever. And you know, I'm thinking to myself, fuck, I didn't. You know, so his letters to the Grapevine indicated, you know, it seems to me a maturity that, you know, he almost ruined the whole thing by thinking, you know, having people think that he, you know, they should go with his God and stuff like that. But thanks to folks like, you know, Jim Burwell and adding that as we understood him, you know, I think that if the folks in AA would have been okay with changing the book or archiving it and putting out another one. Yeah, I think that we agnostics would have had a few things sort of changed around that chapter in the book. Yeah, I can't remember where I was going with that. But yeah, so I was outward oriented. That was very right. I thought that there was a me to find. I thought that you know, the authorities outside of myself, that's where the answers are, and all that kind of thing. And what happened really just in the last 5 years is I because of this self-actualization from being on my own and being able to do whatever the fuck I want. I don't, what I need to do is to be more confident in myself. That's what I need to do. I need to build on myself. And, so for me, that's looked like basically just doing whatever the fuck I want. And it has served me well. And so I have a feeling of confidence in who I am. And at the same time, realizing that, you know, it's a non-existent thing. Well, it's not non-existent. It fucking exists. We all see it. But that it's, you know, for me, there had to be something to hang my hat on. You know, there had to be like some absolute, you know, like we all have a soul or we all have an identity or it's a mystery and this and that. And I'm like, A, I don't fucking know. B, I'm going to waste my fucking time, and I have trying to figure that shit out. I'm not trying to figure it out. That's what's going on. So it is what it is. I experience it and I live from it. But I do know that I can't, you know, people please all the time. I mean, I can do it some, but I can't do it all the time. And I can't do it if I'm forfeiting myself. But there may be situations where I have to, you know, like getting up and going to work. Okay. But I'm not forfeiting myself there. I'm sort of forfeiting what the fuck I want to do, which is continue to sleep. So how did I stay sober? What is the commonality? There was a period of time for like probably 10 years where I might have hit, maybe half a dozen meetings, maybe a dozen, I don't know. And at the time I was doing church, doing scouts, a lot of service work. And, I didn't want to drink, wasn't a thing. But I did realize that I need to be around other people like me. I need, as a, I don't know, recovered alcoholic or whatever, I need to be around people that are doing the same thing. And because of the different kinships, when I lost Rachel, I knew there's got to be some support groups for this. SOS, Survivors of Suicide, and the Compassionate Friends are people who have lost a child for whatever reason. And so I actually did both of those things. It was almost like a, like overlapping therapies that I needed. Each one, ticked a box and felt and filled a need, and AA as well. But not so much AA, mostly those others for a little while. Now I don't do those others very much, but if anyone has been through those kinds of things, I like to let people know that, I've been through some shit too, and if you want to talk about it, I can listen. So with this heart attack, and I'll kind of wrap it up with this heart attack thing, I learned something. I have a new approach. So Zach said to Julie, I think it was Julie who told me, that he said, I wish Dad loved himself enough to not hurt himself. And and when I heard that, and I'm laying in a hospital bed with a bunch of fucking wires and shit and stuff, I'm like, I see. Okay. I think the young lad has a point. And I got to tell you, he's one of the wisest people I know, is our Zach. That's my latest sort of thought pattern, direction, project, if you will, is really focusing on that. So I'll finish with a poem that I wrote. Yeah, that's right. Oh, I got it right here. Because I thought to myself, well, I've been learning to love myself. That's what I've been doing the past few years, especially is doing what the fuck I want to do. Isn't that loving yourself? And I thought, well, it might look that way, but maybe not. Maybe I need to explore more. I need to do different dieting. I have meds. There's stuff that I need to do. I thought that not exercising, well, let me put it this way. I knew that exercising was good for my heart, but I didn't know that not exercising was bad for my heart. I knew that eating shitty food was bad for my heart, but I didn't know that. I'm like, well, this is common knowledge. Well, I don't know. You know what you want to know and whatever. But so I wrote this poem about self-love. So self-love is what? How do I love me? Let me count the ways. I do what I like to do. I do what I like to do when I want to do it. Do I do what's best for me? Can I do what's best for me? What's best for me? I think the word best in this context is an obstacle. I'll substitute the word good. The best being the enemy of the good. Wait. How about healthy? Do I do what's healthy for me? Do I avoid what's bad for me? Wait, unhealthy. Do I avoid what's unhealthy for me? Maybe avoiding what's unhealthy is an inefficient, negative approach. Instead of avoiding, I think a positive approach of doing will yield more favorable results. When I do unhealthy things, it harms me and those whom I love and others around me. When I do healthy things, it benefits me and those whom I love and others around me. And I become a positive role model. I'm conscious and aware, and I enjoy doing what's healthy for me. That's an affirmation. I love myself, so I don't want to hurt myself. I want to do things that are healthy for me because I love myself. Self-love is doing what's healthy for me, not seeing what unhealthy things I can get away with. Thank you, Louisa, for asking me. And I appreciate each and every one of you. And I love each and every one of you, at least in the human condition sort of way, and even more a little bit. That is all.